Clubhouse.
Hey everyone, I'm Mike from Pop Culture Review.
This is Caroline from Daily Review.
And this is Without a Paddle, the Schitt's Creek podcast from Pod Clubhouse. How are you doing, Caroline?
I'm doing good. I'm excited about this one. I thought that these were so, like, silly and fun, and that's always the best Schitt's Creek episode for me. Silly and fun.
100%. You know, part of me is, I'm feeling a little precious about all of these Schitt's Creek episodes because we only have a handful of them left.
Yes. So,
you know, I want them all to be dripping with meaning. But at the same time, I really like this episode because it was really lighthearted and light on any kind of, you know, long-lasting meat other than some of the Stevie stuff with Johnny at the end. It was kind of light on long-lasting effects in the show, and it felt super, super short. It went by really, really fast, didn't it?
It did, yeah. And it almost gave me like a day in the life kind of feeling where it was like you did just wander into Schitt's Creek and you just happened upon this middle-of-the-week story that was going on in their lives. Nothing life-changing necessarily, but like you said, just this is just the haps of the day, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. We haven't actually said it yet, but we're talking about episode 602 of Schitt's Creek. It was called The Incident. It was written by Dan Levy, and it was directed by Jordan Canning.
Okay. Well, I don't know Jordan Canning. Do you?
I think by this point, everyone who's doing anything on the show has probably already done stuff on the show.
I would guess.
So I'm sure he's directed episodes before, but, you know, it's always curious to look back and see what episodes, because, you know, directors tend to have a style, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then you could be like, oh, that's West Wing was always good about this. You know, this was a Chris Messiano show, or this was, Tommy Schlamme episode, you know, or an Alex Graves episode, you know. And then even across shows, directors have a real style. So, you know, it's possible with the really good TV directors, you can almost point their episodes across the universe because they have such a style.
That makes you like such a great critic that you pay attention to all those details. I think that that's what makes TV so fun is that when you can pay attention to something beyond just the plot, but you're like checking out like the wardrobe and the writing and who directed it and what their style was and how it affected that episode, how it made you feel or how it changed what that storyline felt like to us.
100%. And I feel like the more TV you watch, the more you pick up on those things. And I think it actually deepens your appreciation of a show, you know, even a show that, you know, it's not the best thing you've ever seen. But when you look behind the scenes, when you dive into who makes the show, I've always kind of felt that really kind of deepens the connection to the show, even if it's not the show that everyone else maybe says is the best thing ever. Maybe I'm also just too connected to TV. Maybe it's maybe I have
TV
too much of a
relationship.
TV is your
lover.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
As Moira might say to you. I love it.
Are you having a bebé with the TV?
Your bebé. I use bebé like this past week. Like there was like a little one and I was like, look at that bebé. And I was like, oh.
Moira was on fire in this episode.
Oh,
with I mean, she was peak Moira in this episode, coining some new phrases and really diving into social media. But let's back up. Let's talk about the episode, just really quick summary wise. Not a lot happened in this one. Basically, the episode starts with David and Patrick in bed, and he wakes up. And once they establish that there's no bleeding in the bed, we learn that David has wet the bed. I don't know how I feel about that.
I thought at first, okay, did you think it was going to be that he peed the bed? Because I thought we were going like wet dream on this.
That's where I was going too. I was going the same way. That seemed, even that seems a little odd for a grown man, but yes.
I don't know. Is it odd for, I don't know. You're the one with the penis. So you have to tell me, is it odd? Like, do grown men have this?
An actual ejaculation during your dream, that's something that happens to you early in puberty that I cannot recall happening since then. Obviously, the idea of morning wood is a real thing. Yeah, it's often, you know, men definitely wake up with erections and stuff quite frequently, but actually, like...
emissions, if you will.
Yeah, nocturnal emissions of any type are pretty rare for an adult male who is of sound mind and body. I thought it was kind of weird that we're just learning this about David in season 6. You know, it's not that he hasn't had stressful things come up in his life so far in the show, Did you think it was weird?
Certainly true. I mean, I was thinking back to his stress when he was having that panic attack and he actually like went and took the yoga class and everything and he wasn't sleeping at all.
Right.
But I guess in that case, he wasn't sleeping. So I guess maybe that's where it doesn't come up.
Right. But I mean, to the point, he went to see Ted the vet as the only doctor in town because he thought he was having a heart attack and Ted tells him he's having a panic attack. Yeah, he wasn't wetting the bed. Well, yeah, I guess maybe because he wasn't sleeping, then maybe that's why he didn't wet the bed.
Yeah, I don't know.
Which makes you wonder if he peed down Jocelyn's back.
I don't know.
When they were doing the yoga.
I don't know anything about the idea of bedwetting as an adult and having it happen with stress. It does seem like one of those things like that would just be like such a funky little story that Dan knew about somebody else that he like wrote this in.
Totally.
You know,
totally.
It's certainly... They have not shied away from having these moments. It also made me think of when he was babysitting Blouse Barn owner's stepdaughter and she totally like starts her period on his bed.
Oh my God. Yes.
It felt very the same, right? Like where somebody has to deal with it. And I thought they handled that so well. I watched that episode recently and the way that he was like they show his face and he's like holding, you know, he's like biting his lip, but he's like, it's okay. Here's my sister, you know, here's a sweatshirt. Like he handled it like a pro, better than a lot of moms would, you know. I think he did great, but this felt like very much the same.
And Patrick's reaction to this situation, I think, is very amenable to David's reaction, you know, with the period. But that rings true across the board of Schitt's Creek, and I think it's one of the things people love about the show. This is a safe space for everyone. And no one that comes into the creek has to worry about homophobia. They don't have to worry about puberty starting. They don't have to worry about their nocturnal uresis, you know, like which
great.
holy shit, what a great phrase that you don't really hear on TV too much.
No.
But I actually have a question for you.
Yes.
Do you think nighttime oopsie daisy is better or nocturnal uresis? Which is the way you'd want it phrased?
1000% nocturnal uresis. I didn't think oopsie daisy worked at all for this. I thought they should have like gone ahead and workshopped that phrase like a lot harder. I didn't like it. I didn't think it suited Moira at all, especially given that she was not one to like raise her own kids or anything. She doesn't seem like someone who would have any of those phrases in her sphere, you know. I just don't think she would think of it at all. Oopsie daisy is such a wienery thing to say. It did not work for me.
It's very infantilizing.
Yeah.
And which is not the relationship they have. Oopsie daisy struck me as the kind of phrase you would use for someone that you kept breastfeeding until they were 12.
Oh God.
You know, like
yes.
That's a person who has oopsie daisies, not someone, like you said, who was raised by a nanny in a swank penthouse.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't think that's something she would say. I didn't think it was super funny.
I thought it was funny.
I'm not a person who likes the word potty being used either, though. Like I have always just said, go to the bathroom. I've never said potty or maybe I've said it, but I like shy away from it. And so I feel like it didn't really match her. And she's so sophisticated and specific with her word choice. That just felt like, what are you doing? You know, like, what is that?
So specific to the point that Alexis, who I think last week we both agree is the younger sibling.
Yes.
Knew the phrase oopsie daisy and was able to use it as if this was a phrase that had been used throughout their lifetime.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. Have you ever been in a situation where something's so embarrassing? Now, I'm not going to ask you if you've wet the bed with somebody else in it or anything like that. Nothing so specific. But have you ever been in a situation where there's some sort of embarrassing body situation happening and you react like David, where he was like, can you get divorced before you get married? Can you like how he was like, how was your eighth shower? And he was like he just kept like backing into the bathroom, like all those things. Have you ever been in that situation? Do you think that was like a realistic response to that type of thing?
I have had two bodily fluid emissions in my life that were both memorable in horrible ways. One was as a child. I would sleepwalk every now and then. Actually, one of my two sisters also would periodically sleepwalk. And it was a known thing that if you saw me sleepwalking, it was because I had to go to the bathroom.
Oh, geez.
There are a couple stories of me sleepwalking in my childhood where people had to direct me to the bathroom. One time I told my mother I was going to the movies and she said, okay, honey, it's, you know, two rooms down and make a right to the movies. And
that's
I went,
a good, you know, mom. We did not be like, there's no movies, you dumbass. Go to the bathroom. Like,
well, she realized. She realized, I hope. I mean, either that or she was the wine bottle a little too hard that night. I don't
that's
know. But
funny.
I used the restroom, flushed, went back into bed, and then went back to sleep. And that was that night. And one time my sister caught me and was like, no, come back to bed. But I did one time sleepwalk and I made a wrong turn. And instead of making it to the bathroom, it was discovered in the morning. I grew up in Queens in New York, and we had the old fashioned radiators that, you know, would pump out like steam heat.
Yeah.
And I made a right turn instead of a left turn to the bathroom. And in the morning, it was found that the radiator had some kind of leak on the floor around it.
Oh my God.
It was not a leak though. Well, it was a leak of sorts. It was not from the radiator though.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So, but did you freak out, I guess is what I'm asking. Like, so was the response, like, did you just be cool? Did everyone be cool? Did you just like run away? Like, what was your reaction?
I was fine because I was a child. So it was more amusing to me than embarrassing. I think if that same thing had happened even 10 years later, I probably would have been mortified. Or, you know, God forbid, you know, had a girlfriend or a wife find me in that situation or have to explain that in the morning. Yeah. That would have been pretty bad. How about you?
No, I want to hear your second.
Oh, okay. Well, the second one is a little more gruesome. It's a little more horror movie. I was in D.C. I had gone down to Washington, D.C. because I had an interview with the SEC in the morning. This was during my law school career and I was interviewing for jobs. And, you know, so I lined up this job interview with the SEC. Staying at a very nice hotel, you know, the kind of bar where there's lots of like famous faces, you know, all drinking, whatever. Go to bed, wake up in the morning, and everything in the bed was covered in blood.
Oh my God.
The sheets, the pillowcase, the
what
comforter.
The hell?
I had a massive nosebleed while I was sleeping that did not wake me up.
Oh my God.
It looked like someone had been slaughtered in this bed. And I woke up and it was horrifying. I did not know what to do. You know, I bundled all of the bedding. I bundled basically into like a garbage can.
Oh God.
And like a bag. And like, I threw it down the chute. And then I called like the front desk and I said, something horrible has happened.
You're like, someone stuck in my room and stabbed me in the night.
Yeah. And, you know, then I had to get myself cleaned up. I had to get down to the interview. You know, I woke up with enough time to prepare myself and stuff, but I didn't really wake up with enough time to
deal with massacre.
Yeah. To deal with massive blood loss. I was a little woozy. I did not feel great. And I did not get the job with the SEC. But I remember that morning better than I remember most mornings. And I was not alone. I was in a bed with someone, and that was a horrifying experience. Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Well, did the other person freak out, or did they act cool, or what?
She handled it surprisingly well, given the circumstances. But yeah, everyone's blood pressure was pretty heightened in the morning.
It was
not a calm morning. It was a good God, what has happened kind of morning.
Wow, so, that's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy. I can't think of anything that's super specific to me. I was reading on, I'm a part of a Facebook page called Girls Who Travel, and I was reading that it's really not uncommon in like hostel situations where someone gets drunk and like ends up like peeing like at the corner of your bed because they're drunk and they don't know where the bathrooms is, and it's like a communal bathroom. So they just kind of stumble into whatever room, and apparently it's very common for men to like pee somewhere in your room. And it's like, whoa, what's happening? So that was one thing that I read recently. I think that the concept of like reacting like that, if I woke up, I mean, certainly as a girl, I mean, over the years, has there been a time when like unexpectedly fluids have come out of my body? Sure, it wasn't pee. But I think those things are like pretty like, what are you going to do? You know, I think it's kind of expected. Like we all can like hold our pee where like you can't hold everything, you know. I'm not saying I pooped the bed because that would be sad. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just like
sometimes,
you know, things happen and whatever. But I feel like that reaction of trying to like back into a bathroom or try to be cool about it is like universal. Like we can all appreciate, just let me get in the shower. Someone else try to help me. And I think that next scene of like him sitting on the bed and realizing that Patrick has put a plastic sheet.
A wee-wee pad, for sure.
Is that what she's like? Oh, see, wee-wee is in my oopsie-daisy pile of like,
wow. Well, I think it's a wee-wee pad when you use it for a dog.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So I think the same idea is, I knew kids who had the wee-wee pads on their bed growing
up. Wait, what are you, like, I'm thinking it's just like a plastic sheet. Are you saying something else?
No, it's like a thick plastic sheet. It's made for this exact reason. It's almost, it's either like a thick plastic or a thick rubber sheet.
Oh, boy.
Made for this, for the same reason that Patrick cites. It's to not destroy the mattress.
Oh my God, when he said, it's an expensive mattress, even my heart was like, oh, that would hurt to hear the person say,
but,
like,
but what a great exchange, mattress. Though. Yeah, right, he said, and David says, more expensive than my dignity.
Oh my dignity. God, see?
And then he says, it's at least comparable. But but it was so funny because Patrick had been so sweet, which I wanted to ask you, is Patrick's reaction to that whole situation realistic? Patrick is too nice. He is too perfect.
That's where I go back to, like, where did he come from? He is too refined. That is my biggest
understanding.
Yeah, but that's my biggest question mark about him. He is so refined. How did he come from this place where even Jocelyn acts like a rube? You know, like how did he like come from this area and can handle things like this and have such great taste and style and all these things? I don't know. It doesn't really match. Again, we talked about this last podcast, but I need to know a hell of a lot more about where Patrick came from. His reaction, you asked me, right? His reaction?
Yeah, yeah. What did you think of his reaction? Was it realistic?
I think so. I think I would react in the same way. I definitely, if I woke up and it was, you know, an adult person in bed with me and they had peed the bed, really, no matter who it was, whether it was, on vacation, when I go on vacation with my friends, we often share beds to cut costs and stuff. And so even if it was a girl or guy or whatever, I think I would be like, you must not be feeling well, which is kind of what Moira says. Like this happens when he's like full of stress. So I'm going to put that in the not feeling fully healthy pile. And so I think I would think of it like if you threw up or something. Actually, you know what? I have a story about that. My little nephew was staying with us overnight, and I can remember waking up and he was standing at my bedside and I was like, what's going on? What's the matter? And he said my name and I was like, I'm here. What's the matter? And he threw up all over me and all over my bed and all over the sheets. And yeah. And then did the worst possible move, took like two steps back and then threw up all over the carpet. And I was like, no, wait. I like trying to scoop him up and be like, to the bathroom with you, small child. Like, oh no. And I was like, you're totally fine. It's okay. And you know what though? Not unlike David, although he was a little guy, it was like a year later and he's like, I'm so sorry I threw up on the sheets. I'm so sorry. Like the embarrassment factor of having your body do something out of your control and onto somebody else. You know what? That's the second time I got threw up on, though. And I don't mean in a mom way. My cousin did the same thing. I can remember that distinctly now. We were at a sleepover and she did the same thing. She woke me up and she said, Caroline. And I said, yeah. And she threw up in my hair, like in bed, just threw up like over my shoulder kind of thing, you know? And I was like, what's the matter? So, but same thing. It's not like I ever like yelled or did anything other than like, oh my God, how can I help you? What do I need to do to help you? Yeah.
You know, when David says to him, if the roles were reversed, I don't know that I would be quite so generous. one, that struck me as very David, but two, you could see where if it's not a kid situation or like a family member like that, you could see where that's a very defensible position. You know,
I think that's like the level of your love, though. I mean, I got to think if you've gotten to the point of having sex with somebody, then the idea of bodily fluids can't be that gross to you. Right. I mean, it really can't be that gross. I know it's pee and like I'm not into that, but golden showers are for other people. They're not for me.
That's a different podcast.
That's a whole different podcast.
That's a different podcast.
Schitt's Creek might sound like we're going on that podcast, but we're not. we got Schitt's Creek and golden showers. It's a whole thing. But
shits and showers.
Oh, God.
That's new God. Coming to Pod Clubhouse.
Wicked. But I think that the idea of your loved ones, because they are a couple, they're not strangers, body fluid in the bed, it can't be that gross. I mean, poop's a whole different story. Don't get me wrong. If you shit the bed, whoa, that would be a whole different story. I think I would be like, I don't know how generous I could be. I would definitely be like, ew. Like, I would have a hard time with that. Anybody who did that, that would be gross.
True. But it's true. Well, they're very different. They're very different emissions to be in bed with, though, too.
Well, and know? Pee is sterile, right? And we know from Friends, you can use it if you had a jellyfish bite, you could pee on it.
Sure. So, and we know from Dodgeball that it's sterile and you like the taste. That's what Dodgeball tastes. It's sterile and I like the taste.
That's hilarious. Well,
that's what the coach in Dodgeball says.
Yeah. Classic. So given that it's sterile, that seems like it's less disgusting than like poop, which is like, you know, waste material, not sterile by all accounts. Look how many times I said poop in this. Yeah, should I have been saying shit? Like I really messed up. I'm really...
With a CH.
Yeah, shit with the CH. Oh my God. So that entire storyline, I think the embarrassment factor though of being like a grown ass man and everything, this setup of having something like that recorded is tapping into that greatest fear of social media.
It's almost as if what David went through was like one circle of hell, and then having his mother get involved with her social media takeover, you know, pushed him further down a couple rungs in the circles of hell, you know, which hopefully he never finds out about. But, you know,
you Patrick know, knows. There is no way he's not going to find out about this. And there's no way this isn't going to come back.
I would imagine so. I mean, the episode ends. The episode ends with Ronnie texting him about it, you know.
No, but you know, not only is he going to find out, but like something weird ass is going to happen. There's going to be like a hashtag. He's going to be trending. There's going to be like a whole, there's got to be a whole thing. I swear to God, there's got to be a whole thing. Right? Or no?
I think it would be great if it came back a couple episodes from now. I think this is probably the end of this storyline. I don't know that we're actually going to hear from it again.
I think he's going to end up being like a YouTube, like hashtag PP boy or something. hashtag oopsie daisy. Something terrible is going to happen. So
I feel like if they were going to go down that route, it would have ended differently with him seeing the link before Patrick very adorably snatches it out of his hand and scolds him that it's bedtime, which... I love these two. I gotta tell you, these two are just the best. I really love their relationship. And the way, you know, Patrick was just like, it's time for bed, David. It was very cute. And he has his mouth guard in. What do you think of that? So, again, part of the Patrick is this unicorn that is too good for anyone. He tries to level the playing field to make David feel better. And he goes with his his nighttime ritual that he usually hides from David with his mouth guard and then his Darth Vader sneeze guard, nose guard. What do you think about that? Was that a cute gesture? Were you like David that's not so bad? It's not comparable to peeing in bed.
Well, I do know some people who wear like CPAP machines and shit to bed. And I can say those are pretty like frightening when you like put that stuff on and it's like Darth Vader-y. Yeah, it's pretty wicked. I think that if the person I was with did that, like if they pulled out their little retainer or mouth guard and then they got their, you know, nose thing, I would appreciate it so much that they were trying to be like, nobody's, you know, perfect. We all have embarrassing moments or things. So for me, it would 100% work. I wouldn't be like, oh, that isn't good enough to make me feel better. That it would actually be enough. And I think just the fact that he never made David feel like you need to go see a doctor or you need or something like that. Like it was just like, it's okay. Like we'll deal with it. I put the sheets in the wash. Like, it's okay. You're okay. Like that alone speaks volumes about their relationship. It lets me know in my heart, like no matter what comes down the pike, because there's going to be other sad moments or bad moments or embarrassing moments, that Patrick's really got his back. And that is always wonderful to see in stuff like this.
And honestly, despite what David said, I think had it been reversed, I think he would have reacted maybe not exactly as magnanimous, but I think he would have been also very understanding and loving. Because I think that's just their relationship. You know, they are living this idealized, you know, great relationship that I think should be, you know, hashtag goals for everyone.
Well, and I think, you know, I know you're 100% right, because again, you know, Blausbarn, forgetting her name, Blausbarn.
Well, Wendy is the owner. I do not remember what her...
It's okay. The stepdaughter is her stepdaughter. Right. So Wendy's stepdaughter, like he didn't have such like this big long relationship with her or something. And yet he was very compassionate and very cool and very understanding. He would have mugged for the camera. Like we would have seen a lot of faces that Patrick didn't give. But yes. And Dan would have definitely, I mean, the second Patrick went in the bathroom, he would have been making the like, ooh, face and 100%. All that stuff. But I think to Patrick's face, he would have been equally sweet and understanding.
Let's move off of this and talk about the related plot line that comes through with Moira and her
friends.
The crows have eyes social media takeover. So many questions here. I mean, this is like I said earlier, this is some peak Moira. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, also is just Moira at her very worst.
Oh, Alexis, I think you and I might need to purchase antibiotics. I believe we've just gone viral.
What did you think? One, I mean, let's talk about it, because as it relates to the David storyline, she goes into the apothecary and she is live streaming. She's giving a living stream.
A living stream. I loved that.
Patrick, we're creating a living stream.
I loved it.
I mean, that's a classic.
I kind of want to say living stream forever now instead of live stream.
For sure.
When it's a live stream.
Yes. Every episode that we begin at this, welcome to our podcast where we are creating a living stream.
It's a living stream of thoughts.
It's a living stream. Did you think it was realistic that even someone who is Moira and this technology neophyte, she would just think by putting her phone down would end the live stream?
Oh, God, yes. Because it happens with my parents constantly.
Really? Okay.
They can never find the off button when we're talking on the phone. And they only talk on the phone on speaker, no matter where we are. So we could be in a store, we could be anywhere, and they're on speaker for sure. They put themselves on speaker. And then they just leave the line open. And at first they'll try, they'll be like, I can't, I'm pushing the button and I can't, I don't know, it's not hanging up, it's not hanging up. But then it's just like, they're like, meh. Like, I guess it'll time out, you know, and they just like put the phone down. I have been a part of my dad's business meetings. I've been a part of my mom's lunch conversations. It happens all the live long day. And I'm like, guys, and it has to do with their phones, though. They have fancier phones than me. And mine's just very simple. And you just push the button and it hangs up. They have a fancier, newer sitch, and I'm like, I can't even help you. I don't know where the thing is. And sometimes we're FaceTiming and they're just still on there. I'm like, now I'm Sam shopping with my mom for as long as this takes until the battery wears out on the phone. This is what's happening. I will turn my phone off just to finally try to cut the connection.
To end the conversation.
Because for whatever reason on my end, even though I'm also pushing like hang up, I know this doesn't make sense, people. It's like the universe wants me to stay on the line with them. It won't allow me to. It's like, no, I'm sorry. Until your mother or father decide to end this call, you are on this call. So
it's your retribution as their daughter. This is what you need to go through.
That's why I take daughter tax whenever they give me like a $20 bill for like a $15 thing. I'm like, yeah, there's no change.
Yeah, it was exactly $20.
There's a daughter tax for the last time I stayed on the phone when you were like, you were at the sewing place.
So when Alexis is first explaining to Moira about the social media takeover, she insists that she can handle it for her mother, which Moira is obviously a little incredulous that she's going to be able to speak with Moira's voice.
But which is fair, Mike. There's no way Alexis would use the same vocabulary.
There's no way that anyone would say use the same vocabulary that that Moira would use. But Alexis does, for street cred, says that she's dated enough mid-level latte art influencers in her time, so she knows the deal. That was such a specific line. It made me think whether or not this was a thing that Dan actually has encountered in his life, or was he just snarking on, you know, modern culture and Instagram a little bit here.
I think, you know, yeah, I think completely like snarking on it. And just the idea that there are, I think that's really funny to think about, like mid-level influencers. Like the whole whole thing is like, wow, that's just like a whole. My mom at Bunko last night used the word influencer, and I was like, what the frick? Because they were talking about how kids these days like all want to get into fine arts. Like nobody says like, I want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher or something. They're all like, I want to be, you know, a director or an actor or whatever. And my mom's like, or an influencer. And I'm like, who taught you that word? What are you saying over there? I think the idea that there's like mid-level, that's news to me. And I'm like laughing completely about that.
Yeah. And they have to be like the guy, latte art guys. I have to be the one who like make little, like using like toothpicks, make little designs in like your foam and your coffee.
Yes.
Right? That has to be what
that is. That is what I'm going with. And the heart, the Bird, the whatever else that they do.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, some of them are impressive, but biggest mid-level, maybe that's only like 10,000 followers on Instagram. Maybe you're not getting the paid art a latte gigs. I don't know.
I have no idea what makes you a mid-level one. I did want to mention, though, because we were talking about Moira's voice and her vocabulary. Ironically, I was watching a Vogue special 73 questions with Dan Levy, and you guys should completely check it out because it was fun. You like wandered around his house and you got a chance to see his dog, who was adorable. And he was talking about how the different characters are written, and he said he is actually the writer for Moira, and he what he does is he writes what he wants her to say, and then he gets out the thesaurus and changes like all the words to the most like pretentious, crazy, nobody ever says that word. The word that sticks out to me is last episode when she said habilitation, something like that. I was like, oh my God. He's like, I assure you, we will keep him habilitated or something like that. I was like, that's really funny.
That's really funny. That's a fight because we did talk about that actually last
week. I know. And I just happened upon it. I was watching this Vogue thing and then they said it. Like my exact question was like, who wrote Moira? And they were like, I write Moira in the thing. And I was like, whoa, what luck.
But we learned this episode that Moira is not just a fan of pretentious synonyms. She is a coiner, or an influencer, if you will, of new terms. When she enters with her living stream in the apothecary, she introduces us to the word Franz, which is a combination of her fans and her friends.
Oh, my God.
See? What did you think about Franz? Is Franz the new fetch, or is this going to have legs and go somewhere?
Franz. Oof. I don't know. That's a good question. I could see where with things like shipping people, you know, or how everybody like millennial talk is like you say sesh instead of session or whatever, like that kind of stuff. Like, I don't know. Maybe, yeah, maybe it could. Everyone wants a good mashup, right?
I could see myself using Franz in an unironic way, only because... it is kind of funny, the idea, you know, like the way she gets the idea from, what was the user's name?
It was like
Boo Boo Cherry or something like that to do the live stream. Yeah. That's like one of her friends.
It was a fan of hers.
Maybe it was Cherry Bus. It was a fan of hers, but she also considered her a friend. Mm-hmm. There's a window there. There's a column where you could put people in the old Franz column.
Well, I think it's confusing because I think especially if you are not somebody who has been on social media since the beginning, the idea like on Facebook that they're called friends, that is a misleading term, because a lot of times a lot of people will say, I have a lot of friends on Facebook, but I mean that I don't really even know most of them. They're really barely acquaintances or something like that. So Franz for her is actually way more descriptive and accurate than calling them friends or fans or whatever, you know, like she's trying to get to know them and get to know their name. So it's actually a pretty descriptive and right on term.
I think it's easy to mock because Moira is, you know, this really over the top character. But I think she actually may be onto something here. I do not think this is fetch. I think this actually one is something that may have legs and actually may be used, may make its way into the lexicon, which if it does, you know, I think that's a credit to how far Schitt's Creek has come in the last 6 years. You know, it's interesting that if this does make its way into hashtagging on social media.
Well, we'll be sure to hashtag it for this podcast.
100%,
please.
100%. Carolyn and Mike, the two friends.
What is my name?
Caroline.
Yeah. Okay. Just making sure.
Why?
Because you say like Carolyn. I think you said Carolyn last time. And I was like, lying.
I don't think so. No.
It's a whole thing. I have a whole thing. I'm going to start calling you Mick.
You call me whatever you want. Just don't call me late for dinner.
Oh, my God.
I know, super I know,
funny.
I know.
Super funny.
I think it's the second time I've had to show myself out doing a pun on one of the podcasts. It happened when we were doing The Outsider.
Yeah,
the night,
which so. For whatever reason has logged itself in my brain as Mr. Universe. Every single time I mean to say The Outsider, I think the first thing I think is Mr. Universe. It has nothing to do with one. One has nothing to do with the other. It's like there's like a synapse brain fart happening. I might need to get that looked at. Like, I'm kind of scared.
That's pretty funny.
It's true.
So you would think social media would be a natural place for Moira and her ego to want to park. But I think we have seen over the years where she has found... the internet has not necessarily been Moira's friend,
no.
I feel like, over the course of the show. Alexis throws in her face that Moira had once referred to social media as the amusement park for clinical narcissists. And then Twyla throws in her face later on that social media is a cauldron of self-absorption. So, you know, but I think that's maybe just Moira having a bad day. You know, she's an actress, a bit of a diva.
I think she's just of another time. I really do. I think that although she would consider herself like fashion forward or, you know, sophisticated, that type of thing, I think that she is almost, this is going to sound a little funny because she's almost like old Hollywood actress. Like, I would think that someone like, I don't know, Judy Garland or Greta Garbo or something would be like, social media is like for bullshit. You do your acting on the screen and like, that's it. You like leave it there. You play the character, you know, trying to be yourself out in social media and be doing this. I think this it is asking a lot of actresses and actors to try to come on and be themselves and try to be these like characters in this kind of funky little what's reality kind of world. Like, you're interacting with the fans and they kind of want you to just be your character, but also you're also supposed to be yourself because they're supposed to think they're getting to know you personally. I think that's a really funky little gray world they must have to deal with.
And I think it's something that, you know, celebrities didn't need to deal with back in the day, but is very much a part of modern celebrity, especially movie stars, but more so, I think, especially TV stars. Mm-hmm. Between Ask Me Anythings on Reddit and social, you know, Twitter feeds where we expect, you know, interaction or, you know, we hope for interaction with people with the blue check mark, it really puts people who run their own accounts in a difficult position of having to always watch, one, always watch what they say, and two, do that kind of fan service, a little combination of, I am a real human being, but also you can't really be too much of a real human being because the people that want to talk to you, want, right, like you said, they want to see the character.
Let me give you a good example of that. I will tell you that John Hamm is that guy for me. I want him to be Don Draper and only Don Draper. I don't want him to be John Hamm ever, okay? So when I see pictures of him and he's wearing jogging pants, which for those of you girls who don't know, he doesn't wear underwear. And it's a whole thing. So, like, you can watch him walking in videos, and it's very apparent. But he wears jogging pants, like, a lot. And that is not something Don Draper would ever do. So, for me, like, I hate seeing that stuff beyond the jogging pants part. Because it's like, no, it's good business.
Oh, I know. I was worried. I believe you.
Yeah. I don't want my illusion of who that face is, like, I can't even say John Hamm, who John Hamm is. No, he doesn't exist. Don Draper is one character, one guy, and that's the only way I want to see him. We've had a discussion before about the idea of like meeting celebrities, and that's my big thing. It's like, I don't really want to meet celebrities and have a lot of interactions with them, with the exception of someone like Dan Levy or Eugene Levy, because I feel like they are probably so similar to their characters. I would feel like I would know them better. And I could handle that better. Like, it would really bug me to see Dan Levy dressed like a slob or dressed really like where you just look at him and be like, David would never wear that. Like, that's so lame. But he himself dresses so fashion forward and everything. You're like, okay, that I can handle Dan being a real person in real life. However, in interviews I've seen, Dan has said that Eugene is actually a very serious person. And especially as a father, he's a serious father. Like, he's not jokey. Which you might not think. You might think he would be very slapsticky or something. And Dan said, no, he's not like that. He actually is a very serious person. And this is like his craft. And so he thinks about being funny and he is funny. He plays that part. So that might not be that fun. Like, can you imagine sitting down with him and expecting a really cheerful, laughing kind of guy and getting this really serious, monotone Eugene? Would you feel like, I don't even want to be here? Like, no, just I want to keep you as the actors version, you know, of that character. I can't love on Eugene right now.
It's interesting, you know, and I think comedians are probably the biggest example of don't try and meet your idols because they tend to be very different in real life than they are when they are on stage performing or in their movies. They tend to be much more serious. They tend to be much more manic. If they are expressive and not kind of quiet and serious, they tend to be more emotionally manic. The thing they tend not to be and this is not a broad stroke. I mean, there are obviously exceptions, but my experience has been the thing they tend not to be is a joke every 30 seconds, which you may think from whatever they're on or if you've seen them in stand-up is how they really are. It's definitely one of those things. So yeah, I don't know that you would want to. I mean, I would love to sit down with Eugene Levy to pick his brain, but I don't think I would go in there thinking I was going to get the Johnny Rose show. But I think most people may not think that. I think most people would think that they're getting the Johnny Rose
and
show.
That would be so disappointing, right? You'd be like, or maybe not even pick Johnny. Maybe pick, you know, one of his characters from, you know, one of the movies where he's doing true, like more slapstick kind of goofy kind of stuff.
What, like Bringing Down the House, you know?
Yes.
You know, like I don't think Eugene Levy is really like he is in Bringing Down the House.
That's funny. Although, Catherine O'Hare, one of the things that in watching more of these interviews and stuff, it is so interesting. Obviously, that's a put on with her voice and that kind of weird affectation she has with her voice. But she has like a pretty serious Canadian accent when she just talks in her own voice. It's really funny and a little unnerving because I've seen her on lots of shows that where she's not speaking as Moira, and I didn't realize that she has quite a Canadian accent. It's funny. All those things would mess with my mind. You know, I don't think I would love a lot of that stuff. Meeting them in person.
Before we move off this, I want to just assure you.
Yes.
I actually met John Hamm last year at South By.
You did?
Yeah, I got to spend a couple minutes with him on a red carpet talking to him about Good Omens, actually, where he had a recurring role. And ladies, he's the real deal. He is exactly as kind of put together and suave and as attractive as you think he is on TV. He really is that in
person.
He
wearing a suit?
So. He was wearing
then,
a suit. He looked very
then see then I up. Feel like he was like in character. I'm telling you, when you see the like the pictures of the whatever you want to call them, those just like paparazzi type where he's just walking down the street or walking his dog or something, I'm telling you, he's slob city. And so really the main question I want to ask you is, do you think he was wearing underwear under that suit? Because I'm guessing no.
You know, we didn't actually get that far in our conversation.
Oh, you could have just looked. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
I mean, I pinched a nip, but I didn't actually get to the underwear conversation.
I'm glad to know that he comes across like smooth in like speaking with him. That's good to know.
But yeah, smooth, but not in an obnoxious way. He actually seemed like very much like the kind of guy. He's the guy guys want to be and the guy that girls want to be with. And he comes even talking about, you know, playing Gabriel in Good Omens comes across exactly the same way. Not really pretentious, but I mean, just so fucking smooth. For sure.
Love it.
You know, yeah. Which you can't say about everyone.
No.
I, you know, getting to do a lot of interviews and press lines and red carpets, I've met a bunch of people. And for the most part, meet or exceed my expectations. You walk away. And for the most part, my experience has been like, wow, you know, even with the kind of chaos of the situation, like pretty good
pretty
person. I have met a couple of people, though, where I have put that in my old little notebook. What a douchebag. Well, it is what it is. I don't think I really idolize anyone in Hollywood that it would break my heart. But it is interesting. It is a little behind the curtain when you come across someone or you interview them and then they leave you with this like you just sucked on a lemon taste in your mouth of like, ew.
Yeah, or just that they're so polar opposite. Like one of the examples for me is everything I've been told about Alexis Bledel, who plays Rory on Gilmore Girls. I would like her to be a likable, easy to go person. And apparently she's not. Like, she's pretty stiff. She's not somebody you can really have a conversation with. That bums me out. I never want to meet her because I never want to mess up Rory in my head.
Yeah. If you hold dear a character in your head, the best advice I have for you is never meet the person
mm-mm,
who played them.
Mm-mm.
You know, even, you know, because you're rolling the dice and it's definitely stacked against you odds wise that it's going to live up to or exceed what you're hoping for in your head. Just let that character live on. Never, ever meet that actor.
I could not agree with you more. I agree.
Yeah. All right. So let's head into this final section of the episode. For me, was the most important kind of plot-wise, story-wise, Schitt's Creek-wise, and definitely emotionally resonating was the building of the Rosebud Empire.
Yes.
Did we ever get the impression that this was the next logical step for for Johnny and Roland and Stevie was that there was going to be a Rosebud Empire.
I think that...
Is this the first time we've ever heard about
this? It is the first time that I think I've ever heard of it, but I do believe that Johnny just has that franchising whatever in his blood where he feels like if you have a nugget of a good idea, then you may as well have like the same thing 2, 3, 4 towns over, you know? So I think that that's logical. I was going to ask you about this in terms of... what is the obsession with funerals? Do you know how many funerals that they dealt with on this show? We go to Carl's brother's funeral. We had Aunt Maureen's where we had to go and spread her ashes. We went to the funeral home. That's one of my favorite scenes is when they're in there and they can't find her ashes. And the like helper guy comes and he's like, oh, we found the ashes. They were sitting on top of the microwave. And the other guy goes, what have I been using as creamer? Because he's been like sprinkling Aunt Maureen in his coffee every morning. Yeah. I was like, oh my God. But for a show that's only been on, you know, this is only the sixth season, to have like a, where I can rattle off that many funeral scenes, and they're pretty macabre things. I mean, the whole Danny Boy thing was like hilarious. We have the
Well, that's the thing. It's not just that it's funerals, it's that they're accidental funerals. You know, like, there's no reason that Johnny Rose or anyone should be at Carl's brother's funeral or at Benny Dykstra's, Dirkstra's funeral. So it's not even about macabre death, it's just how do you keep finding yourself in a... What are you doing wrong in your life that you keep finding yourself in a situation where you keep winding up in these situations?
You know. I think it's hilarious. And obviously somebody must have that as like a nugget of like, this is the funniest thing, the idea of being at a funeral, because they just use so many jokes, the baby crying in the funeral, the, you know, the whole, how did he die? And they're like, this is the darndest thing. He's trying to untie his belt from a fan and it caught to his neck. Like that whole, like,
But what's the best part of that? Oh my God. The best part of that line though, is that he says with such reverence, he's like, he really found the studs on that one. Like, even in death, he is complimenting his handiness that he was able to really install that fan like a motherfucker.
And that, like, he completely also missed. He wasn't untying a belt, you know, like, but it's like, that's how, like, sweet the town folk are, you know? You're like, oh.
For sure.
So, okay, so we have this funeral. The idea of expanding and going to other motels, interesting. The one thing I would say about that is that I hadn't gotten the impression that the Rosebud Motel was doing so well that they had the capital or the whatever you want to call it to expand. Like, I didn't think we were having all these, I don't know, like an influx of guests.
I thought about that briefly, but I didn't really bump on it too much. And I'll tell you why, because it made sense maybe coming off of the awards, the Motel Awards storyline from last season, that even if we don't see it, and the show has never really, unless it serves the plot of that episode, we've never really seen any guests at the Rosebud Motel, but clearly it has stayed open. Johnny has something to do with himself for most of the day. I think it's just kind of implied that maybe it's not burning down the house busy, but it's doing well enough that this is a legitimate thought of expanding or creating this quote-unquote Rosebud Empire. I was more put off by how willing Johnny seems to be getting in bed with Roland. What in your years of living in Schitt's Creek so far have really made you think Roland Schitt is the guy I want to get into business with? Stevie, I get.
All I can figure is that he would have the connections and of anyone in the town, potentially the capital. I mean, of anyone, because small towns are so interesting in how ancestral the money is. Everyone is eating at the same restaurant, and then that, you know, the restaurant owner is then shopping at the one store, and then the shop owner is going to the one mechanic. Like, the money just gets passed from one pocket to the next, but it's like the same money, you know, like nobody's getting rich. Everybody's just passing the money to the next person. So he's the only one who has any chance that maybe there was any amount of like past money or anything. Jocelyn maybe brought in some, I don't know. She at least has like a teacher's salary, I suppose, but I don't know who else would have looked like a better partner, really, when you think about the townspeople, like who would have had any money?
I guess Roland has remained kind of employed now with the motel for some time as like the handyman. But yeah, it just seems, I don't know. It's just, that's a recipe.
I think it's far-fetched that Johnny would have left the phone call and setting up the meeting to Roland. That's far-fetched.
Yes.
I mean, that How busy could Johnny be doing what?
Not,
you know,
not far-fetched though that Roland made that call while he was mowing his lawn. Not far-fetched.
And I love that he mixed up the words of a showing or a viewing. Like, that's amazing. And like something that is like, that does seem like if you're from, you know, a small town or someplace where you don't get out much, you just don't really know that there is a difference. A showing and a viewing seems like, well, that seems like the same word, you know, and it's like, oh, no, those are very different things.
A couple quick questions, and then I want to take you to the end of the episode. One, did you find egg salad an appropriate funeral food?
No, I think that's gross. Because I think it's smelly. And I think the whole point of like flowers and stuff at a funeral is to like keep things smelling light. And I think egg salad is smelly.
And also it can be a little too mushy for finger food.
Yeah. And it invites mouth sounds, which I'm real anti. But especially at a funeral, you need to keep your food quiet. Mm. Quiet food.
Did you know what a Bonspiel was?
No. What is a Bonspiel?
Well, it relates to their conversation, so it makes total sense. A Bonspiel.
Is it like a curling something, I assume?
It is a curling tournament.
Okay.
It is the name of a curling tournament.
Hilarious.
So the late Terkstra, Mr. Terkstra, was a big curling fan. And yes.
You know,
so
this is interesting.
I had to look it up. I was like, what is that? I had no idea.
That's really funny. It's interesting that they really leaned into the Canadian references in that whole curling Bonspiel business, because again, in an interview, they asked like, where is Schitt's Creek supposed to be? And they specifically said, we didn't ever say where it is. We didn't say whether it's in the US or it's in Canada. We never say. When they came to the Canadian powers that be to get the okay to do the filming, they actually acted as if there was going to be some pushback if they said it was an American family. Because, and this was Eugene's words, he was like, because the powers that be would be like, why aren't you having a Canadian family being in a Canadian town? Like, why would you not choose to represent us? So he was like, in order to not even deal with that, when they said, well, this must be an American family because you have them with a house in New York, we actually came back and said, no, they have a house in New York, a house in Toronto, a house in Paris, a house in Italy, everywhere. So as to keep them as vague as possible. And we never said where it was because we want you to feel, which is this interesting because you and I talked about this in the previous episode, to make you feel like it's an island. There's nothing beyond Schitt's Creek. You don't need to know what state it's in because all you need to know is the borders of this town, because that's all there is for this. And I thought that was like, okay, that makes so much sense. I get that. So even spreading, oh, and he was laughing. He was like, oh, and there's Elmdale, which I was like laughing.
Right. That's like the outskirts. And then you go into the Nether territory, which is
Amish. And then just nothing. You just fall off the face of the earth at that point. But hey, I didn't know the Canadian powers that be would be like anti-American family or whatever. I was like, ooh, look at that. A little snark out of them.
I think I had read somewhere that Dan eventually did say that it was in Canada in an interview. Mm. But interesting, I was reading quotes a couple of weeks ago for the show. And this was from the first episode when the feds knock on their door to start repossessing their house.
Okay.
One of the written quotes I had read said that it was that they were introducing themselves as the Canadian finance, like the Canadian version of the IRS.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't think my closed caption picked it up when I rewatched the episode, but I think there may be hints that it actually is Canada sprinkled around. I have to go verify the written quotes. It was from a site.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, it was from a site that's pretty reliable about quotes. It was a line. It was definitely a line. And usually that stuff is taken from shooting scripts.
Sure.
So I wonder if maybe it was edited out at some point.
I don't know. I mean, they were very clear about it, that they were like, we specifically don't tell you where Schitt's Creek is. And I was like, intrigue. Okay. So I thought that was funny. I was like, interesting.
Picking up on our conversation from last week, what did you think about Mrs. Terkstra, Betty Terkstra? She struck me because you brought this up. And so I've been thinking about it. And she struck me as one of those classic one-off casting choices that Schitt's Creek has always been so, so good at. You know, she plays this widow, this kind of solemn widow, grieving widow inside, and then goes outside and starts yelling at them about her shady husband and her poker in his poker ring and gets really on. Like she almost sounded like an Italian mob dame
Oh, you know? Totally. She was like, I don't know anything. I don't know. And like, no, I thought she nailed it. I loved when Roland tries to like, interrupt her. And she's like, am I still talking? And he's like, yes,
oh, my
ma'am.
God.
I was like, I need to use that a lot more, too. It would just be like, am I still talking?
I thought of you when she was scolding him. When she was scolding him, I was like, in the right situation, Caroline would be the person who would say, I am still talking. Have I stopped talking yet? Not always.
Hilarious.
Not always, but the right situation. Yes.
That reminds me of, I was at this meeting and we were doing this like kind of group work kind of thing. And I was taking notes in a Sharpie and this guy who had known me for a while was like, do you have like a pencil or something? And I was like, no, I only write in Sharpie. And he's like, of course you do. Because it's like, you're so fucking confident that you're never going to erase anything. Yes. Of course you write in Sharpie, like the biggest, boldest freaking letters ever. So that toed is definitely what would lead me to the, am I still talking? Have I stopped talking? Like,
so funny. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no,
I was like, whoa, Chris, that was like kind of a bitch thing to say to me. Like, Jesus.
Love it. I love it. My favorite part of the structure was when she's talking about the feds coming down on her with the poker ring. And she turns and she says, she's got the look of a fed all over her face. It was so funny because what a random line. And I was like, does Stevie look like she's got fed written all over her face? I don't know.
I have.
I don't even know what that means.
I don't really know what that means either. And I go back to the like, it is so hard to picture Stevie as anything other than what she is. Like, I am stretching my little brain to be like, what else is this woman going to turn into? I don't know. I don't know what she's going to do in her, you know, like Converse knockoffs wearing flannel life. Like, I don't know where she's going.
Right. Well, this was, we talked about this a little bit last week. This was a big takeaway of the conversation that she started to try and have with Alexis last week that got aborted and didn't go anywhere. I feel like she finally gets the words out that she wanted to say to Alexis last week. I think she finally gets out this week with Johnny, which makes sense because, you know, over the last couple seasons, he's really grown into this father figure for her. We actually have a clip of the scene of what she says to him.
Mr. Rose, what I've been trying to talk to you about is more than just the new motel.
Ah, well, what is it, Stevie?
I don't think I'm ready to commit to this business, like, as a whole.
Oh. Well, that is a bigger conversation, isn't it?
It's just doing cabaret made me feel like I should push myself. And so I just wondered, you know, maybe there's something more out there for me.
Well, what are you saying? You want out?
No. I don't know. I feel like I'd regret it if I didn't at least try to see what's out there.
Yeah, I think this was kind of what she has been trying to say to herself and everyone else since this cabaret kind of blew her up. She doesn't know what she wants to do, which is what your question was last week, but she knows she needs to try and go do something. What was your takeaway of this end conversation? I call the Stevie confessional.
I thought basically what I had thought the previous week, which was like, I need to understand more about the direction we're going with you, Stevie, because I'm having a really hard time picturing you dealing with anything in the entertainment industry. And I don't know what other skills you're bringing to the table. I thought it probably would have been more natural to me that she does have an opportunity to get out of the town because of the franchises. And maybe she suggests, you know, a place way further away, and she's going to run her own business and do her own thing somewhere else, just to get out of the town. But I just kind of felt like I am struggling. I have a pretty darn good imagination, Mike, and I can't for the life of me come up with another job for this lady. So I really need more as to like, what is it you think you want to do, you know?
For sure, for sure. If anything, I think it's interesting. I think this is an interesting end game arc for her. And, I agree with you. I don't know what else she's going to do. And neither does it sound like she knows what she's going to do. I mean, when she's talking to Johnny and kind of stammering through her thoughts, she very much is, I don't know what it is, what the it is, but she feels that she has this feeling that there has to be something else out there. And even if there isn't, she thinks she owes it to herself now at least to go see.
You know whose response I loved in that, Mike? I loved Johnny. What did you think of like his exact words of like how he perceived this news and like took it in and then like came back at her with the encouragement? What did you think about that? How he did that?
I think it was, I loved it. Actually, we have that clip too.
Either way, I hope you find what you're looking for.
Mr. Rose, thank you.
I think it was exactly what you would expect where their relationship has come. When I talk about like their father-daughter relationship that I see it less with Stevie interacting with Johnny as much as I see it much more with Johnny, the way he has kind of taken to Stevie. And, you know, he says, you know, I hope you find your way back here, which is his selfish part. But I think his predominant feeling is what he says next is, you know, I just want you to be happy, kind of. Essentially, he says, I want you to be happy and I want you to go, you know, be whatever you need to be. I love that. I love that. That's Schitt's Creek. That's where Schitt's Creek really shines for me. I love the silly oopsie daisy, you know, and the streaming and all that. But these moments, these are the moments that I'll think about after the show is off the air, those interactions.
I completely agree with you. I think that this is the relationship that really feels like it brings the heart to the show when you have these like the townies plus roses. I think that that's where you're like, yes, yes, this is what I need. I think the irony is that all four roses will stay in the town, and to have like Stevie leave and Ted be in the Galapagos, and like, you know, the idea of like having these adventures and the roses are the ones that stay put and kind of hold down the fort is kind of hilarious, right?
Yeah, no, for sure, for sure. But it definitely feels like it's heading in that kind of way.
It does. And like that they're shaping the town. Like in theory, this town is going to be more hopping. Like if they are doing successful enough business to actually be able to expand, then when I was talking about that money that's just going around in a circle, they're bringing in new money to the town.
Yeah. Nope, for sure.
That would be amazing. So where Speaking do you rate this so far in like episodes that you've seen? Do you rate it in the upper half, lower half, somewhere in the middle? Where would you rate this episode?
I think this is, I think it really was just an average episode of Schitt's Creek, except for this end scene. I think this is one of the more earnest moments of the show. Yeah, I think the show has a lot of earnest moments. I think the show has a lot of, you know, the heart is pumping blood, big emotional feels to it. And I think this is one of those scenes, this end scene is one of those scenes that will be memorable for me. The overall episode, just kind of, you know, just an average, you know, Schitt's Creek that makes me laugh out loud in certain parts, which, you know, very few TV shows do, but not upper echelon shows. How about for you?
Good to know. I feel like this one was the middle of the pack for me only because there's so many episodes that have these really great one-liners and they're just stacked on top of each other like a layer cake. And in this case, I felt like there were some good one-liners, but not, it wasn't so dense. So that's why it goes to the middle of the pack. And that in such a great series, that doesn't mean boo. I mean, it's still way better than so many other shows, even when it's middle of the pack.
Yeah, like pizza. Even a bad episode of Schitt's Creek is still better than almost anything else you're going to find anywhere else.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And not that this was bad. I mean, I actually definitely had a couple chuckles, but it was really light calories on some good Schitt's Creek heft, you know?
Well, I look forward to continuing to review this with you. And this has been Caroline with Daily Review.
And this has been Mike with Pop Culture Review.
Thanks so much for listening.
Bye.
Join us on our new venture called Pod Clubhouse. Come on over and listen to more podcasts from a variety of collaborating podcasters.